Well, we're very happy to kick off our 50th anniversary celebration. We're going to have a bunch of podcasts in the coming year, and there's only one guy we can start it with, and it's Sam Wyche, the former player and Super Bowl coach of the Bengals, and he's been very kind enough to join us this morning from Pickens, South Carolina. And first of all, Sam, great to talk to you, and if you could just give us an update on how you're feeling.
I'm feeling good. I am. This is just after the 4th of July week, and I have been exercising, riding my bicycle. I try to do between 15 and 20, every now and then 23 miles, about 3 to 4 days a week, depending on whether I'm traveling or not. And the doctors say I'm way ahead of schedule. I've had 5 biopsies on my heart where they cut a little spot in my neck, and they send a tube down that finds my heart, and they can scrape some microscopic tissue to see if my heart shows any sign of rejection. All 5 got A pluses, no rejection. So I got a very strong heart, Jeff, and I don't know who the person is or where he or she lives, but the doctors say this person obviously was in good physical shape, probably a lot younger. I'm 72 now. I know that's hard to believe looking at my pictures.
Sam, you always had a big heart, so I got to believe there's a little bit of a transfer there, too.
Well, I actually, when they put the new heart in, I felt 20 years younger, 30 years younger. I don't know. At 3 weeks and 5 days after that transplant surgery on September the 13th is when I had the transplant, September 13th, 2016. Mm. 3 weeks and 5 days after that, I rode 15 miles on my bicycle on a trail, which was up and down hills. It wasn't just around a track on flat ground. It was, some of it was coasting, but a lot of it was climbing hills, and my heart didn't blink, and I felt good. I felt I wanted to go again, but doctor, that's enough for today.
We're so happy that you're feeling great. I mean, I think people know you here as most people know you here. I think the younger generation, they know you, they understand you. You were the Super Bowl champ, but I don't know how many folks are left to remember that you were an original Bengal, a quarterback out of Furman, and I was just going through the records, and you were actually came off the bench to beat my Boston Patriots in the last game of the 1970 season. I guess Virgil Carter got hurt. And he left in a 7-7 game, and you threw the winning touchdown pass, which ended up as a winning touchdown pass in a 45-7 win. I believe you threw it to Paul Robinson, and you ran for a touchdown, and you threw for another touchdown later in the game. So, folks, Sam Wyche could play.
Yeah, I didn't get in a lot of ball games. I was definitely a backup quarterback. That was my lot, but I'm happy with that. I was ready to play. If they'd hand me a lead, I could hold it for them most of the time. In fact, I don't remember ever losing one with the lead going into a game. But
well, you got them into their first playoffs. That was that won the division 1970, and you got them into and that was their first playoff berth, and went from there.
Played that first playoff game, the Baltimore Colts, Johnny Unitas to Raymond Berry. I still remember the guy that broke the game open was an out pattern to Roy Jefferson. Mm. And we went for the interception, didn't get it. Mm. He went up the sideline, made it 7-0 in the first half. And I can still remember Paul Brown walking over to Bill Walsh on the sideline. I was on the sideline with a clipboard but at that point. And Paul said, keep this clock running. I don't want to get blown out today. And Paul knew more than we did. I mean, Bill and I looked at each other. It's just 7-0. We're in the second quarter. It's not like it's a blowout at all. But Paul knew the playoff situations, young team, all the ingredients that go into making a comment like that. Let's keep this thing under control. And if we win in the fourth quarter with a comeback or a big play, they don't have time to come back and match it. That's the way to win this game.
Yeah. Go back, Sam. Bring us back. The reason I'm calling you, talking to you, really is a couple days ago I wrote a July 5th, 1968, this day in Bengals history, the first day of training camp. And that day, back in the day, I think you guys were up in Wilmington damn near close to 2 months, and it was the first day ever that the Bengals were working. Can you give us a little bit of a flavor of what that first camp was like?
Well, we're at Wilmington College, which is a beautiful place, and I love it. I remember it fondly. However, it was hot. It was in the dead of summer. There was no air conditioning. Paul didn't allow any window air conditioners or anything. We'd have a fan.
Yeah.
And we would work out in the morning, and then we'd work out again in the afternoon. We'd have meetings at night. And by the time you got through working out in the morning, you came back and tried to hydrate yourself because you just perspired so much on the field, and then you had a hard workout in the afternoon as well. We were working with what was called isometrics at those days. That was before the Bengals switched over to Nautilus and then over to Pete Brown's company. It just went right out of my head. I was going to give him a plug here.
Yeah, Hammer Strength, anyway, Hammer Strength, I think, right?
What was it?
Yeah. Hammer Strength, right?
Yeah, Hammer. I'm sorry. That's what the years are catching up. But at any rate, Hammer Strength, this was before that, and the isometrics was in vogue. And isometrics means you're pulling against something that won't move. So you're just working your muscles, and they were system of ropes that your partner kept tight. And then we go out and we have our workout. Paul always had us hit the field at the same time, by the way. This was, he would dress the team in the meeting room, in the cool of the meeting room. We had to keep our shoes off because we had to walk out through the hallway of Wilmington College. We didn't want to tear up their tile. And then we would sit in that breezeway right there. You remember, you were there, breezeway before you go out on the field, and you put the shoes on,
right,
the cleats on, and everybody, when Paul saw everybody was ready, they bunched up at the gate at the entrance to the field, and he said, let's go. And we hit the field, did our calisthenics, and then of course went through the drills. Paul had a deal where on the first day of training camp, you put in one run and one pass. That was it.
Yeah.
Which gave the defense a terrific advantage as soon as they saw what the run was. I'm sure we ran it right and left formations so we could run it right and left, but at least the defense knew which hole we were hitting.
Was that first camp, those first couple days of that training camp, how weird was that? It's a new team. It's a new team. You got a legend out there that hasn't been in the game for 5 or 6 years. Was it, and I guess he was bringing in guys every day, right?
Yeah, every day we would do it. It seemed like every day. I don't know if we did it every day, but it was a lot of waivers being passed on as soon as they made a decision that person wasn't going to make the team or wouldn't make the team better. And they would waive that person, and then, of course, they'd bring in somebody else to try out and see if we couldn't build the team. And at the end of the long, you were right, it was probably close to 2 months that we were in training camp. Now the players, of course, after about 2 weeks or a week and a half, they start getting ready for preseason games.
Right.
Almost said exhibition. The commissioner would have been unhappy.
Oh, that might have been another fine, games. Sam, that might have been another fine.
No, and I'm about $3.50 away from the world record, too. So, I just remember laying in that bed, perspiring, your sheets are getting soaked, and you're trying to, you might have a gallon of water that you had prepared, or orange juice, which was good. I always loved that.
Yeah.
And you got as much rest as you could. And honestly, you learned the system very well that way because you didn't have a lot thrown at you at one time.
What was Paul like that first camp? What was he like?
I remember the first time I met Paul, I was standing watching. I was out of, wasn't my turn to take the next snap. I'm standing there, and Paul walked up to me. I honestly didn't even notice. He kind of just quietly walked up to me, and then he reached over and he said, my name is Paul Brown. And I looked at him and said, jeepers, I'm shaking hands with one of the all-time greats here. And I shook his hand, and by that time it was my turn to go in and take the next play. So he was very quiet. He moved around. He was watching all the positions. He was making comments to coaches who would then pass it on to players more likely than not. Remember, there were a lot of young players that were first-year, maybe second-, third-year players, and then you had a handful of veterans. I remember Ernie Wright, a few of the guys that were in that lineup that kind of stabilized it at the very beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he pretty much basically said the kids are going to carry us, right? I mean, and I guess that was the right way to go.
Yeah. Well, I think Paul knew exactly what kind of an offense and defense he was going to feature that first year. Don't make too many mistakes, which means you don't have too much to choose from, but at the same time, you knew where to go when the ball was snapped. Formations were not as big a problem in those early days. In the 60s, you usually saw pretty much a wide receiver on both sides of the ball and a wide, a tight end on the line of scrimmage and two backs in the backfield. Occasionally, you'd see a back, break and go into the slot or so that you'd have a full wide receiver look. But he made sure that everybody knew what to do first. I can remember, though, Paul going into the meeting rooms, and he would write the word why, W-H-Y, ? And then he'd underline it several times. And he would turn to the team and kind of fold his hands over that podium. And by the way, in that team meeting, every desk had the name of the player that was supposed to be sitting in that chair. The quarterbacks were on the front row.
Right.
And that way Paul could just look over and see who was not on time.
Yeah.
But he would write why on the board, and he said, if you know why we do something, everything from why we do calisthenics before practice, why we run the trap play the way we do, why we, you know, throw the pass with a certain protection, if you know why, then you'll remember what to do. If you know what to do, you'll know when to do it. And if you know when to do it, you're going to know how to do it, because we're going to practice it all week long and have you ready to play. And that was his message, and he repeated it over and over during that first training camp. And in fact, he repeated it over and over in every training camp that he was there.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember, you know, his first talk was, you know, it's become legendary. Every year he would give the talk. And as a matter of fact, Mike still opens camp, and he'll open camp this year with a talk. Do you remember Paul's first talk that camp?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I've got a copy he gave me when he hired me as the coach in 84, as the head coach in 1984. He gave me a copy, I think it's the 1978 edition, which wasn't but about three words different than the 1968 edition.
Is that right? He just didn't change, did he?
He didn't change much. I mean, I went back and looked at my notes. I took extensive notes, by the way. In fact, he gave me when he hired me as a head coach, he handed me back my playbook from 1968. He kept one playbook every year from one of the players that he thought took good notes or the best notes.
Yeah.
And that first year he kept mine.
How about that?
So I got my 1968. I have it here in the house. And
Sam, that should be in Canton.
Back and forth between the years that follow.
What might be the most interesting thing in that notebook, do you think?
Well, you know, the thing is almost the minutia part of it. Yes. He would say, men, I want you to be courteous to the ladies that are serving us in the dining hall. They're working hard, and they're tired as well. You say please and thank you. I mean, the general social behavior that he was concerned about, that every player represented the team well on and off the field. I remember that simply because it struck me as, I thought we were getting ready for football games here, and you're coaching everybody on the details of what they do in between practices getting ready for those games.
Yeah. Do you think that first camp, did he talk about big issues like race or anything like that, or you know, that was 1968 was a hell of a time in the country, and you know, you were bringing, you know, you had guys from everywhere, you know.
Right. No, I don't remember Paul addressing, for example, race or the relations between the races. That locker room is a different place from American society, and excuse me, but they. Players, once they get in that locker room, they're teammates, and teams are families, and it doesn't take long once you decide that that guy's going to help you be a part of a winning team, that you ignore the color of his skin or the background or what city he came from, or maybe he came from a rival college, you know, that you had a big grudge against years before. All that goes away, and everybody becomes part of that one family, and I think Paul probably, as much as any coach I ever worked with, and all of them address that.
Yeah.
But Paul probably set the tone for that as good as anybody.
Because you had guys from everywhere, and that was the thing. I mean, you know, you had Paul Robinson from the West Coast, and Bob Trumpy from Utah, and Bob Johnson out of Tennessee, you know, and Speedy Thomas and those guys, and it was just to be able to get those guys ready as a unit in 2 months. I mean, it's quite a challenge.
Well, he met the challenge, and not only him, of course. Boy, I haven't had that orange juice yet, Jim. Give me just 1 second.
No, you're good. You're good, Coach.
Did you hear that cough real good? Now I'm back to home.
There you go.
But he had a plan for the training camp benchmarks that he wanted to hit, and he hit them in that first year. The first year, I can remember getting ready. I don't even remember who the team was, but I can just remember the atmosphere getting ready for that first real game, real meaning regular season game. And we were competitive that first year. We didn't get, nobody just came in and manhandled us. Sometimes the score would look like that may have happened, but we were right there in ball games. We were not, we didn't look like a team that didn't belong. We belonged right away, and it was because of the preparation and training camp. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever lose track of, there were so many guys coming through, did you ever lose track of who you were throwing to or who you were handing off to? Or did you ever did you just bump into guys? Or?
Well, I suppose it probably did if somebody wasn't there very long. And, you never really got to know them, where they were from, were they married, they have kids, all those kind of things. But The team molded pretty quick. I mean, we were all in the same boat. We knew that it was a short fuse, and you had to perform every day at practice, or it could cost you your job.
Yeah.
And if you got cut by an expansion team, there were very few teams that were going to pick you up. That was just the nature of the business. And they figured that the expansion team was looking for all the good players they can find, and if they didn't want you, the veteran squad didn't want you either down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, did their guys just stand out right away to you? Sam, some of the players, I mean, were there guys who you just said you knew, ooh, these guys are going to be good players?
I mean, there were some, like Bob Trumpy, for example, there's a tight end that ran like a wide receiver.
Yeah.
I think Bob Trumpy was the first tight end, I'm told this, in, excuse me, Jeff, I got to clear my throat one more time.
Go ahead.
That's good. Guess I should have brought some water. But one of those gallon buckets of water would be great right now.
Right out of Wilmington. But, you could have Marv Pollins pour it for you.
Yeah, I think I've still got one on my name. You took a magic marker, by the way. You made sure you put your name on your bottle, your plastic gallon to your jug. But, a guy like Bob Trumpy that was a wide receiver, when he was running routes, he could get open. He was big enough and had great feet, took good angles on the blocking part of it. I can remember Bill Walsh bragging on him about that because Trumpy was a slim guy. He wasn't, bulky-looking guy. But he could run down the field. And you've probably heard me tell this story, but there was a game, I think it was against Kansas City, I believe. Kansas City or Oakland, one of them. But anyway, I remember the pass that I dropped back, and I threw the ball 70 yards in the air, and he caught it and took two steps into the end zone for the touchdown. And Bob remembers it as it was a pop pass for Wes. I threw it about 5 yards, and he outran the field for 70 more. But the truth was that it was a long pass. I don't know if it was 70 yards, but, 50, 55, 60 yards, something like that. And he did caught him in stride. But that play marked the first time that Paul Brown actually moved the tight end out as a receiver. Yeah. And Trumpy was the widest guy, and the flanker moved inside of Trumpy in a slot formation, two receivers to one side, and Trumpy ran the post pattern, and they lost, their coverage, and it was a good pass for a change, and he walked into that end zone or ran in that end zone with the first catch.
Now, was that
tight end that wasn't playing in the tight end position?
How about that? Now, was that in the preseason? Was that in the preseason in '68?
No, I think that was a regular season game. In fact, I don't remember. It's too long ago. And I'll tell you, the preseason games, two of the players, was like a regular season game because we were on trial every preseason game.
Yeah.
We were still trying for the team. But I think this was a regular season game. And I didn't start, whoever started, Dewey Warren maybe was the start of that at that moment, and got banged up and I went in. But the story is funny because every time the two of us are together, one of us starts to tell the story, we know where it's going. And I cleared it up in my book, by the way. I've finally got a book after all these years being asked to write one.
Yeah.
Coming out in a few weeks, by the end of July, it should be on the shelves and on Amazon.com and all those things, called Third and Forever.
Yeah.
And the analogy there, of course, is on third down, if you don't make the first down, you have to give the ball up, you have to punt.
Yeah.
And life's the same way. You run into all kinds of roadblocks and distractions and so forth, and if you're not conscious making the third down, theoretically, you know, hypothetically, a third down situation, then you've got to give the ball up. But if you make it, you keep right on going.
When we wrap this up, I'll make sure you give all the information for the book, the websites, and all that. Because
right.
I did want to plug that. But, you mentioned the name there, Bill Walsh, who obviously was the Paul Brown's top offensive assistant. Left, became the head coach of the 49ers, won three Super Bowls, went to the Hall of Fame. And I guess you met him that first camp. What was your impression of him, that first training camp?
Well, you know, Bill and I were not very far apart in age. I played 1 year of minor league ball in West Virginia, going back and gotten 1 year of graduate work, getting my MBA from the University of South Carolina. And that's where, and I was assigned as a grad assistant to a young defensive backfield coach named Lou Holtz. Lou called Rick Frazzano, who's on that first staff,
right,
and got me invited to a one-day afternoon camp over at St. X High School. And Paul Brown called me in the office after that and signed me to a contract, and that was my start of my relationship with Bill Walsh. But Bill, I remember Bill's room, all the coaches had rooms on the ground floor, and Bill would leave his door open, and after morning practice, the coaches retired as well as the players, and I would walk by and I'd see him laying in bed, usually with his arms folded behind his head and cocking his head up a little bit. And he'd call me in, or I'd just step in and say, "How you doing?" And we would start talking, and our relationship became pretty informal, as well as, of course, the football part. But Bill was, he showed a lot of insight, very detailed guy. Everything had to be exactly specific to the play. I think Paul Brown preached that to all the coaches, but I was, of course, dealing with Bill. And then later, Bill, we ran into each other in San Diego, or in Tokyo, when Bill was with San Diego, and I was with the St. Louis Cardinals moving around the league. And in a preseason game in Tokyo, Japan, and we had a 45-minute conversation over a cup of tea, and I finally looked at Bill and I said, "We're not having tea, you're interviewing me, aren't you?" He laughed, and we could kind of tell when there was a joke coming from either one of us. And I said, when I said that, he said, "If I ever get a head coaching job, I want you to come coach the passing game." And ultimately, when he got that 49er job, he did. He called me, and I took the job.
That all started at Pickett Hall, walking past his room and seeing him in the room.
Yeah.
That first
camp. And I would always stop because the door was always open.
Yeah.
And we felt comfortable with each other. So we would just, chew the fat sometimes. Sometimes we talk about what we did in practice that morning or what we were going to do that afternoon.
Yeah. What was he like that first camp? I mean, it was his first shot in the pros, you know?
Yeah. Well, I always tell people that he had he was left-handed. He never clapped going from right hand and left hand coming from opposite directions in front of your chest. He always had a glancing blow with his left hand over crossing the palm of his right hand when he was making a point or trying to drive home a point. And I can remember just Bill's mannerisms when the play was being installed was, "We're going to get this right, we're going to get this right, we're going to do it exactly this. It's a five-step drop, you plant, you hitch, you throw, and if it's not there, you go to your number two, and then their number three, and then we ended up saying 1, 2, 3, and then a guarantee, a layoff guy." So it was memorized, and that was the system that he took to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Modified somewhat because he had some time there with Don Coryell in San Diego, but that was a system that later became known as the West Coast offense. It was really pretty much started in the foundation of it in the 1968 Cincinnati Bengals team.
Yeah, and he did. I mean, he coached the receivers for like the first 4 or 5 years. Then he started to coach receivers and quarterbacks. But I guess really he was, if you're coaching the receivers, you're working a lot with the quarterbacks.
Yeah, we're receiver coaches. Either the quarterback coach or the receiver coach, and then when you go to 7-on-7 drills, where they go skeleton drills, everybody but the pass rush and the pass protection, those coaches coached everybody. Yeah, because the quarterback had to know exactly where the receiver was going to break. The receiver had to know exactly what the quarterback was going to read and when he was going to be the number one receiver. And so we all worked very close together on that in the passing game.
How were the crowds, Sam, at Wilmington? What was it like? Was it, I mean, people?
Good crowds, yeah.
Yeah, people were pumped up, right?
In the air, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Paul Brown coming to Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have several thousand people that would. In fact, we had people that would come up and spend 3 or 4 days of their vacation.
Yeah.
And they would come to practice every day, morning and afternoon, and watch the team. And then, I guess they went on and. Wrapped it down the river somewhere for the last half of their vacation, but they really were into the expansion of the NFL, then the AFL. This was prior to the merger of the AFL and the NFL, which then became the AFC, American Football Conference,
right.
And the NFL's National Conference, but all under the auspices of the NFL, National Football League, which is the way it is today. Paul Brown played a big role in that as well.
Yeah.
All of the Rooney family and the established teams, like the Chicago Bears, for example, all of those teams saw that the AFL, AFC to become, and the AFL in those days, was going to be a success. It was just an expansion of the NFL, and they wanted the merger to happen, and it did.
In 1970. And big crowds came up there in 68, right? I mean, there were they came from all over, I guess, to see this new team. And a big thing was Paul was back after being in exile, basically, for 6 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Paul was a star, no question about that.
Yeah.
But they wanted to see Paul, and a lot of them came from areas where they supported for years the Cleveland Browns, but they also supported Paul. I guess I'm assuming that some of them took Paul's position in the when he left Cleveland, our Modell, and he got in, different sides of his, of whether he should stay or not, but they were switching allegiance to the Bengals, and there was an immediate fan following.
Yeah.
Didn't have to have too many T-shirt giveaway days to do it.
Yeah, well, and I guess too that you guys could sense that from the training camp crowds. I would imagine that there was a little bit of excitement.
Let me tell you, it makes a big difference when you're so dehydrated and your muscles are yelling at you, "What are you doing to me?" When your legs are burning and everything else, and then to hear the crowd yell because one of the players makes a big catch or something, and the crowd is following it as if it's a real game, and they respond in like fashion, and then you get pumped again and you're ready to go. It's amazing what the crowd does in terms of get the best out of the players in practice.
One of the guys that gets forgotten, I think, on that first team, Paul Robinson went for 1,000 yards, the running back. And
right.
Sam, how good was he?
Paul was a long strider. I tell you who Paul reminded me of later years with Stanford Jennings when he was playing for the Bengals when I was head coach. But Paul Robinson was that style of player as opposed to, say, a Barry Sanders who took those short little side steps and barely picked his feet off the ground.
Yeah.
But Paul could get outside. He had a little move where he could just kind of turn his shoulders slightly as if he was going to take the hole inside, and as soon as that defender took one step, he bounced it outside.
Yeah.
He did that a lot, and nobody seemed to catch on, I guess.
Yeah.
But he was a special player and an important player in that first year.
Yeah.
Because you had to have a balanced, run, pass, attack. You couldn't have go in with just one of them, or they'd shut you down.
Anybody on that defense who, was kind of a, Paul was an offensive guy, But anybody on that defense strike you those first couple of weeks?
Cheryl Hedricks did.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember him or not, but
big lineman, right?
Big linebacker, wore number 69, and veteran player. I don't know how many years he had in the league when he got there, but a lot.
Yeah.
Ernie Wright was another one who came from San Diego, who's a veteran player and a big. He was one of, really a big giant of a man in those days. Now everybody is Ernie size in the offensive line and bigger.
Right.
But we had some leadership from veteran players. We had just enough players that we knew were going to be good as soon as the team was good around them,
yeah.
Including like the first draft pick, Bob Johnson from Tennessee at the offensive center.
Yeah.
He was an All-American and played like one, but Bob that weighed 265 pounds in 1968 at offensive center. Now, they're fullbacks of the league the way that now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just, that was the different time, but the league was getting bigger and stronger, and weightlifting and conditioning techniques and diets were getting more defined, and teams have just gotten bigger and bigger over the years.
Yeah, the Robinson obviously was a big player on that team, and Trumpy, who you talked about, and Bob Johnson was really Paul got some blowback for taking a center with the second pick in the draft, but back in the day, center was, it's as it is now. It's an important position. I think he saw Bob as kind of a stabilizing guy with his personality.
Paul Brown used to say, you always, when you build your team, always start with the people closest to the ball.
Yeah.
That'd be your offensive lineman and obviously your quarterback, because he's got the ball in his hand after the snap.
Yeah.
But the people closest to the ball, well, obviously the center is the closest. He's standing there with his hand over the ball waiting for the snap count to come to signal that he's going to bring the ball up to the quarterback. But that was Paul's philosophy. You build and you make sure you've got a good, strong offensive line and a quarterback that can move the ball. And, of course, in a couple of years, we're going to pick up a kid named Greg Cook that could have turned out to be one of the greatest quarterbacks ever to play.
Yeah,
he was unbelievable as a passer and a scrambler, and had the look of a superstar when he walked off the field with that blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, Greg Cook was the first person, this wasn't in year one, but it was a couple of years later, when they drafted Greg Cook, he was the first person I ever saw use a blow dryer in the locker room. We used to make so much fun of him.
Yeah.
He had that long, wavy hair, you know.
He was the Midwest Namath, right?
Days, you didn't do that.
Yeah, he was the Midwest Namath, right? I mean, he was...
We used to laugh. I'm not even sure they had plugs. I think he had to bring an extension cord from the ground plug. They didn't have plugs by the mirrors in those days.
Was there anything from that first camp, Sam, that Paul ran that you used in your first camp in 1984 as the head coach of the Bengals?
Well, a lot of the plays will start there. A lot of the blocking schemes, and which carried on into San Francisco, where I, later went and got another dose of it. 4 years with Bill Walsh, and of course drafting Joe Montana didn't hurt, having a great quarterback. And the schemes, though, the terminology was overlapping. I'm very familiar with that, and brought that back when I came and still used it. And then of course we connected that up with the no huddle offense. But Bill and Paul, really thinking back on it, the training camp and the installation of the plays, what you called them and the way you drew them up to the playbook, very, very similar. Bill was admired Paul Brown very much, and thought he was the break of a lifetime to be able to start out with him in the NFL in 1968.
Yeah, and you had that in the notes that you've taken in that, the notes you took in 1968, what you're saying, it was as much football, there was as much off-field stuff as it was football, it sounds like.
Well, I think it was probably more football, but the off-the-field was emphasized with the same aggressive comments and the same look in his eye when he wanted to make sure you understood that this point is important to me, and it better be important to you guys sitting up there with your name on your desk, because that tape could come off real quick.
Yeah.
And we'll put another name on there.
Yeah, yeah. The Sam, talk about your book a little bit, and as we wrap this up, and where folks can get it, and if there's a website involved.
Yeah, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Ingram's is going to distribute it in the bookstores and hopefully in airports. This is a great book to pick up as you're going on a long trip.
Yeah,
because they're short chapters. And it's called Third and Forever.
Yeah.
And the analogy, of course, is third down and long. You better make it or you're going to have to give the ball up.
Yeah.
And it's got a big picture of me looking like I know what I'm doing.
Beautiful.
But it's about 275 pages. Yeah. It's a nice read. Each chapter is only about 3 to 7 pages long, and that's it.
You going to do any book signings? You going to do any book signings or...
I'm putting all that together right now. We just finished, by the way, I mean, literally last night, we finished the final editing of this and putting some things in that one of the chapters talks about we're playing Pittsburgh and one of the coaches from the Steelers, we lost the game by 3 points, had a chance, we were driving down, the clock ran out on us. Comes down and says, "Well, that's wiki wacky for you." That's where the name wiki wacky started. It was in an elevator full of reporters.
Yeah.
But he was talking about a play. There was about less than 20 seconds, I think, left on the clock. The clock was stopped. But it was third down and a yard. And our plan was get that first down and then give us one shot, either in the end zone or whatever, down by 3. And, we couldn't tell whether we made the first down or not. Bruce Coslett was up in the booth.
Yeah.
And I'm yelling at Bruce, "Did we make the first down?" He says, "I don't know. The Steelers won't get off the pile. The officials are just standing there looking at them. There's nobody calling timeout or, you know, stopping the clock while they unpile. It's obvious what they're doing," which is pretty smart coaching, by the way. Chuck Knowles, sharp guy, that was another Paul Brown legend. But, anyway, the clock ran down. I said, "We can't wait any longer. Send the field goal team on." When the field goal team gets on, and the kick is hurried, and we don't make it. I'm not sure we'd have won the game anyway. That would have tied it up.
Yeah.
It would have been a long field goal. Had we made it, Jim Breach made a lot of those long field goals that we didn't think were in his range in his day, though.
I want to say, Sam, that was the immortal Dick Hoke, I think, who was credited with Wiki Wacky, the running backs coach for the Steelers.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
We don't use his name in the book, but we just say, "Hey, Pittsburgh Steeler." But what he didn't realize when he was coming down that elevator was that there was a reason for it being chaos, and it wasn't the coach's fault. It was the officiating should have stopped the clock until they see if it's a first down.
That's why you got to write a book, Sam.
Well, I know. But the reason is, if it's third down, now becoming fourth down, you couldn't clock it. You couldn't stand up and just throw the ball into the ground and stop the clock because it would be on fourth down.
Yeah.
You turn the ball over. If we made the first down, we could clock it.
Yeah.
So if we did not make it, we wanted to go on and just take our chance for the long field goal. And, but anyway, that story is in there. And
that's great.
It's finished with a positive note in that Chuck Noll and I were talking at a league meeting years later, and it actually was right after I got fired by the Bengals and hired by Tampa Bay, and he leaned over to me and said, we were friendly, by the way, very friendly. A lot of people think we had, just because we're the same division, that we battled things out all the time. That wasn't true.
Right.
But he leaned over and he said, "Sam, do you realize you're the only coach, active coach, in the National Football League that has a winning record against me?" "No, because I remember you kicking my butt up, like every time we went."
"Yeah."
"No, you're 10-6. You won 10, and I've won 6. Of course, now you're not in Cincinnati, but in those days you played home and away.
Yeah.
And you're 10-6. You're the only coach with a winning record, much less a pretty strong winning record at 10-6.
Yeah.
So when the assistant coach comes down the elevator, forgetting the fact that they didn't win, the majority of those games, the Bengals did, even though we're an expansion team.
Well, Sam, for this 50th celebration, this is going to be like 1990, and I'm covering you for the Post. I'm going to harass you all year, and this is going to be the first of many Sam Weish podcasts, because everywhere you look, you're in Bengals history, whether getting them into the playoffs for the first time in 70, leading them to the Super Bowl in 88, coming up with the no huddle. I think next to Paul Brown, you're the most influential guy in Bengals history, and I'm going to tap you, and it's going to be just like 90. I'm going to harass you, Coach.
It's deja vu all over again. Don't you bear it.
Great to hear you, Sam. Great to hear you. You sound terrific. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you later, Jeff.